Welcome to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with my brother Rick, we examine current events in the light of God's prophetic word. Wow, what a time to be alive. You know what? I am so thankful that God gave us his word, that he communicated to us what's going to be happening in the last days. God is omniscient. He knows everything actual and possible. God is also eternal. Psalm 90, verse 2, as the eternal omniscient God, he has lived our yesterdays, our todays, and our tomorrows, the past, present, and future. God is the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. Revelation 21, 6. On today's program, we have Ken Timmerman, David Dolan, Itamar Marcus with Palestinian Media Watch, Paul Scharf, of course, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung in the Legacy Series, and Rick and I will try to wrap it all up at the very end of the program. Rick, we've got a lot to cover, so let's get started with our first, Ken Timmerman.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. I have Ken Timmerman with us. He is our expert on geopolitical affairs. He's an author and an analyst. You can find out more about him by going to his website at kentimmerman.com. Ken, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Ken, the big news of the week is obviously the Trump-Putin summit. Can you tell us about it?
Well, what we know, Rick, is that this was a long time in coming, and Putin was not going to come to the table until the president really upped the pressure. We talked about this last week, the threat of a secondary boycott, in other words, the U.S. Increasing sanctions and tariffs on buyers of Russian oil, mainly China and India. That is what got Putin to the table. So it's been, 7 months now, 8 months. Trump is quite frustrated. He's been trying to get Putin to the table. He thought that he could do it in 24 hours to solve this war. Obviously, that's not been the case. So they met at the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, which is Alaska's largest military base. It's kind of a combination, if you wish, of the Air Force, Elmendorf Air Force Base, and Fort Richardson, which is an Army facility. I think they were there pretty simply to control security and also to control access to the media. Trump did not want to be facing any kind of public protest over Putin's presence, which could have happened had they met someplace else in the United States, or even if they had met in some neutral country, say South Korea, there could have been protests on the streets. So this gave him an opportunity to completely control the environment. Look, I think we know what the basic outlines of a ceasefire are going to be. All right. And people are going to debate this, and they're going to come out of the summit. And they're going to say, well, it's not this, it's not that. But here are the basic outlines, and they've been known for some time. Russia is going to keep Crimea. They had a referendum there in 2014 after they seized it during the Obama administration, and we did nothing. People in the West say that referendum was bogus, but there were actually international observers to it. In fact, one of my former colleagues was an observer. He was there with the International Republican Institute from Washington, and he said there was nothing out of the ordinary. So Russia's going to keep Crimea. Second of all, Russia is going to keep the Donbas, which is this eastern region of Ukraine, about 100 miles inside the current border. That's what the Russian army occupies today. They're going to keep that. Why? Because it's all Russian-speaking and basically Russian nationals who live there. The issue is going to be that Putin is demanding more territory that his army has not yet been able to seize. And, there was a lot of hand-wringing this week, Rick. Zelensky went to Berlin on Wednesday to meet with the German Chancellor Merz and have phone calls with President Trump and other European leaders. There's been a lot of anxiety and hand-wringing that President Trump was going to give away Ukrainian territory. And Trump has made very clear he's not there to negotiate on behalf of the Ukrainians. He's not there to negotiate a territorial deal. He is there to get a ceasefire and to get the process moving forward. So that's what this is about. It is a process summit. He wants to have some form of ceasefire. It could be a ceasefire in the air war, for example, where Putin pledges to stop attacks on Kiev and the Ukrainians pledge to stop attacks on Moscow and other Russian facilities. But President Trump clearly wants progress. He wants something to show for this. And the results may not be immediately apparent.
Well, one final question on this summit. We look at this entire situation, and I'm asking you to take off your reporter hat right now. And like you said, we may not know the effect of the results of the summit for quite some time. But when you're looking at this situation, what do we want? What would be a good resolution here? One thing that I would somewhat be worried about is, you know, Vladimir Putin being rewarded for his aggression. But then again, you've talked about the issues with Ukraine. What would be a good resolution to this situation?
Well, at this point, I don't think there is a good resolution. Putin is going to be rewarded in one way or another. Let's not forget, he was the one who started the war. He is the one who sent his troops across the border in 2022 and opened hostilities with Ukraine. Now, he has all kinds of excuses for why he did it, but none of those hold up. None of those hold up. Putin started the war, and he is going to win territory as a result of that war. That's a fact. It is not a very pleasant fact. It is not a good solution. It's not a good result, but it's real politics. It's what's going to happen. Without that territorial concession to Russia, there will not be an end to the war. Putin has signaled very clearly he's willing to continue fighting. His troops continue to make advances further into Ukrainian territory in the Donbas. They don't yet control the whole region. The Ukrainians are putting up quite a fight, and they have a whole a series of defensive cities, if you wish, forts that are protecting the interior and hampering the further advance of Russian troops. So the Russians are willing to fight for a long time. And if the Europeans and the United States and the Ukrainians, who, by the way, in a recent poll at 65% said they were fed up with the war, if all of us want this war to end, there will be concessions on the ground made to Russia, like it or not.
Well, Ken, we'll await the results of this summit, and I'm sure that's something that we will talk about next week. But let's move on in the time we have left and talk about Iran. Your latest book, The Iran House, talks about essentially the inner workings of what goes on in Iran. And, you know, you look at the situation in that country right now with the defeat at the 12-day war. Now Iran is basically at an inflection point. What do they do? Do they continue to be defiant, or do they work on diplomacy? Where is Iran headed right now?
Well, look, I think the supreme leader, Khamenei, faces a dilemma, this strategic dilemma that you mentioned. Do they continue nuclear diplomacy at the risk of a fracture inside the governing coalition, or do they continue their nuclear program and risk perhaps another Israeli airstrike or U.S. airstrikes along with Israel? I happen to think that when the regime is given a choice between regime survival and getting hit, they would rather get hit than risk the regime. So I suspect that they are going to try to restart their nuclear weapons program. They're already burrowing into Fordo, trying to get down there. I think that's going to take them quite some time. But I think they're going to basically thumb their noses at the international community and keep the regime together, the hardliners inside, the Revolutionary Guards, as well as the hardline mullahs. You have the president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who is on the other side of this. And he said last week that resuming talks with the United States, quote, does not mean we intend to surrender. And he said that nuclear diplomacy after the war is a good thing. You don't want to talk, he said. What do you want to do? Do you want to go back to war? This is a direct quote from Pezeshkian. Well, he's in the minority, and he is also, I think, on the losing side of this argument, because if they talk to the United States now, it will be in a position of weakness. And when the Iranian people see that their leadership is in a position of weakness, I think that will embolden the people to take action against the regime.
Final question for you, Ken, and I know that this is something that is very important to you. We talk about what happened in Iran since the 12-day war. One thing we do know that is happening is persecution of Christians that's been stepped up since the end of the 12-day war, and that's something that is being replicated around the Islamic world. Can you talk about Christian persecution, especially in the Middle East and the Islamic world today?
Well, the Iranians have been going after house churches for years, and Khamenei himself, already in 2010, called Christian house churches a critical threat to the regime. Ahmadinejad, the former president, also said he was going to shut down house churches across the country. And they're a critical threat because they reach deep inside the regime itself. They reach into the Revolutionary Guards. So among the tens of thousands of people who've been arrested since the 12-day war, there's a widespread crackdown trying to find Israeli spies and others. That includes 43 Christians arrested, not so much as spies, but because of their Christian faith and their involvement in the house church movement. But Iran, ironically, here is not the worst offender. I mean, there was a new report that came out earlier this year from a number of Christian groups, including Open Doors, on the status of Christian persecution worldwide. And, you know, it's sub-Saharan Africa, Rick, where things are just abysmal. They're unbelievable. 150,000 people have been killed by jihadi groups over the past 10 years. And we're talking about Nigeria, we're talking about Congo, we're talking about Sudan as well. It is all over the place. 16 million Christians have been displaced, driven from their homes across the region. I will say this, that the State Department under Marco Rubio is paying a lot more attention to this than either the Biden administration or the Obama administration. And I expect you will see some real significant initiatives from the U.S. to put pressure on those countries, Nigeria, Congo in particular, but also southern Sudan, to stop the persecution of Christians. The president hasn't yet gotten to that. Okay, he's now 8 months into his presidency, or almost 8 months into his presidency, but he'll get there. I'm pretty convinced he will. He will get there. He cares about this. He said so publicly. He will get to this, and you will see something significant coming from the White House as a benefit to those Christians who are being persecuted.
Ken Timmerman reporting for Prophecy Today. Ken, as always, we appreciate your insight. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Rick. God bless.
Great job as always, Ken. Don't go anywhere because we have David Dolan coming up with our Middle East news update right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
Kramer with Mission Network News. This December, India's Maharashtra state plans to roll out the nation's strictest anti-conversion law. John Budaiti of Bibles for the World says,
quite a number of people are being arrested under these laws. Churches are being attacked, you know, in the middle of worship, and they'll file false charges or charges of conversion against pastors and some of the worshipers there.
The state is looking to change the framing.
They are now trying to position Christian activities, not so much in the anti-conversion terms, but as anti-national. And so that will be easier, they feel, to prove in a court that this is upsetting the Hindu majority.
Pray for Indian believers to stand firm in their faith. And Christian persecution, including widespread debt bondage, is on the rise in Pakistan. A small change can lead to a lifetime of slavery. MNN's Lindsay Koh has more.
According to Bruce of Uncharted Ministries, financial emergencies can force Christian men and their families to move onto Brickyard. They make bricks to pay off their debt to the owner, but with high interest and low wages, an estimated 3.5 to 4 million people are trapped in debt bondage in Pakistan. Uncharted Ministries works to rescue families like that of Ahmed, a Christian with three children, including a daughter whose legs were severely damaged when a Brickyard truck ran over her. The debt Ahmed owed was only $700, which has been paid through the help of Uncharted Ministries.
They just are so thankful, and they never imagined to be set free. That's one family of dozens that we've been fortunate to pay the debt and work with.
Prayer points and more at missionnews.org. Lindsay Koh, Mission Network News.
Thanks for listening to Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. We're listener-supported by people just like you. So by giving to Mission Network News, you enable us to keep the stories of God's kingdom coming. And together, the Great Commission happens. Look for links at missionnews.org. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today Radio, the program that looks at current events in the light of Bible prophecy. Well, this is the portion of our program. We call it our Middle East News Update. We look at news coming out of the Middle East in general, but Israel in particular. To do that, we have with us journalist Dave Dolan. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
Blessed to be with you, Rick.
Well, Dave, as you do every week, you give us an update on what has happened in the past week. What's the latest?
Well, Rick, this weekend marks exactly 20 years since Israel pulled out of the Gaza Strip. 8,000 Jewish residents evacuated, many of them forcefully by the army.
And of course, communities were abandoned, 18. And the Palestinian Authority went in the next week, this coming week, 20 years ago, and bulldozed all of those Israeli communities, didn't use the housing, destroyed all the agriculture, etc. But Ariel Sharon said, we've got to do this. The White House wants it. That was President George W. Bush at the time. And there was, of course, a great controversy in Israel over it. I covered all that as a journalist. And this week in Gaza, we still had action going on. The Israelis are back, not because obviously they wanted to be. It only lasted 18 years before they had to go back in. And the war's been going on now for nearly 2 years. The IDF announced Friday it had sealed a four-mile tunnel in Beit Hanun. Now, that's a suburb of Gaza City where they intend to go in and capture the entire city beginning after the Jewish holidays in October. That, of course, is if there's no accord with Hamas or ceasefire with Hamas. And by the way, those talks resumed this week, Rick. As I said last week, the Israeli announcement that it was going to take over the entire Gaza Strip was really meant to put additional pressure on Hamas to come back to the negotiating table. They now say they are interested in doing that. And Israel sent a delegation. Netanyahu sent the head of the Mossad and others to Qatar during the week to resume talks. Meanwhile, there were more airdrops of aid, food, and medicines into Gaza. And a seventh country joined that. The little country of Singapore in South Asia joined three European countries and three Arab countries in doing these airdrops. That, of course, is all coordinated with the IDF and Israeli authorities. The main story in Israel itself during the week, Rick, was the announcement by Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich on Wednesday that over 3,000 new home units will be built between Jerusalem proper and Maale Adumim. You know that well. It's in Hebrew, it means the red ascent, or it can even mean the blood ascent, and that's because when you're coming up from the Dead Sea, all of the soil there's very red, and it's been called that for centuries, basically. This is the E1 plan that Smotrich was talking about. Now, that's been on the books since the mid-70s, Rick, and we had in the 80s, the Likud government, after they came to power, tried to build this area up between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim, which, by the way, today has 38,000 residents. It's technically an Israeli, quote, settlement, but it's a big suburb of Jerusalem. And of course, Israel extended Highway 1, the main highway from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, over the north end of Jerusalem and built a tunnel in the Mount of Olives, the northern end of the Mount of Olives, to connect Maale Adumim with the city. It's just a quick drive in and out, but it's all unbuilt in between. And Smotrich said, we will build there. We have a right to do that. And he admitted that this would, quote, bury the Palestinian state proposal, because it would eliminate the last land bridge between Ramallah, north of Jerusalem, where, of course, the Palestinian Authority is headquartered, and the areas that control south of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, that whole area. So it would effectively block the route between the two Arab areas. And, of course, that's why it's very controversial, and European leaders condemned it, and Germany condemned it, and the UN condemned it, etc. But it seems to have a lot of support in Israel, and, of course, it would strengthen Jewish control over East Jerusalem, and it would isolate the Arabs living in East Jerusalem from other areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority. So there's a lot of screaming going on about that. And finally, to the north, Rick, we had action in Lebanon again on Friday, major IDF bombardments in the Nabatea area, not far from the Israeli border, as Hezbollah has been recreating its control of the area. They're not supposed to be doing that. And that's after their leader said during the week that they would not hand over their arms to the Lebanese authorities, the Lebanese government and army, which, of course, the president, Aoun of Lebanon, last week demanded that they do that. So we have that going on. And meanwhile, on Wednesday, Turkey signed a military cooperation pact with Syria, the new Syrian regime headed by an ex-Muslim militant, as we know. He says he's ex, but of course, Turkey itself is rather radical in its support of Hamas, etc. And they also, Turkey, said they would send troops in to help the Syrians learn how to run the new military equipment they plan to provide to Syria. So that alliance is strengthening, and the Israelis, of course, are very concerned about that. All that to say, the war is not over, and more trouble seems to be ahead.
It certainly does. Well, David, lots to follow up on there. But one of the things that I want to talk about, one of the reasons we have you on this program, is you were an eyewitness to history. You spent so much time in Israel, and you were certainly there during the Gaza handover, as it were, you said 20 years ago. If you could you talk about your thoughts, your recollections at that time? And can you talk about how you felt this was going to work out? And if you saw something like October 7th in the future?
Well, Rick, we all knew that the Palestinian Authority, of course, that was created out of the Oslo Peace Accords in 1993, headed by Yasser Arafat. We knew that it was weak. We knew that Hamas, which was founded just as I went to work for CBS in 1988, they issued their charter in late 87, calling for Israel's complete destruction. Muslims cannot be ruled by Jews. There must not be a Jewish state in land that Islam has ruled, etc., all in their charter, that they were very popular. And when they won the 2006 parliamentary elections, which is the last time that they were held, Rick, they were supposed to be every 4 years, that hasn't happened, we knew that Hamas won that handily, and it won in Gaza as well. And of course, the next year, they threw the PA out, actually threw some of the PA leaders off the top floors of buildings and killed them that way. Dozens were killed in that coup, and they've run it ever since. Well, that's exactly what Bibi Netanyahu, he was then not prime minister, it was Ariel Sharon, who made the decision to agree to the U.S. basic demand that Gaza be handed over to the Palestinians. And Sharon said, they can have it. It will be their state, and we love it. We grow a lot of our food there in the south end of the Gaza Strip, but we can do it elsewhere. And the neighboring communities, Rick, were all for it. They're the peaceniks, we call them, the kibbutzim, the ones that were attacked on October 7th. And yes, it was predictable. Netanyahu said it will be Hamasstan before too long. He said that in 2005. He was very strongly opposed to the withdrawal, as were many Israelis, especially the Likud party and its followers on the right. And the religious parties, too, for the most part, were against it because Gaza is listed in the Bible as part of biblical Israel, as part of the land that God promised to the Jewish people. And there was a Jewish community in Gaza City until 1948, when, of course, the Arabs declared war on the nascent Jewish state. They kicked all the Jews out of the area. And here we are, these many years later, 20 years later, and we're at full war. We've had six, I think, skirmishes over the years with Hamas and Islamic Jihad founded by Iran, throwing rockets into Israel periodically. We've had incursions by the IDF, but never staying very long, just to kind of clean out the nest of resistance. But we saw what Hamas did, took most of the aid money they were getting from Qatar and other places to build an underground network of tunnels. And, you know, we think of a tunnel as something you pass through, but of course there's rooms down there, there's kitchens, there's electricity, air conditioning, etc. Of course, the hostages are mostly the remaining few, maybe 20, are in actual tunnels and being hardly fed. So that's the reality of it. It was a disaster. Hamas has to disappear, but they are still, the polls show, strongly supported by a majority of the Palestinians. So they're not so easy to get rid of, as it were, but at least if they're not militarily controlling that border, Gaza Strip border area, Israel will be a little bit safer. But Hezbollah is still in the north, and we had a couple more rockets from Yemen, from the Houthis during the week, missiles aimed at Israel, and we have Iran again threatening Israel. So as I said earlier, the war is definitely not over.
Dave Dolan, keeping us updated on what is going on in Israel. Dave, as always, we appreciate your insight from a political historical, but also a biblical perspective. Dave, thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, you know, I'm glad to do it, Rick. God bless.
Great job as always, David. We've got to take a break, and when we come back, Itamar Marcus with Palestinian Media Watch, what the Palestinians are saying, and then we'll have Paul Scharf talking about the times of the Gentiles, what that means to the times in which we're living today. Let's take a break right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. Syria's government says it thwarted a recent bombing attempt on a Catholic church. It's an answer to prayer for protection for Syria's believers. But Todd Nettleton with the Voice of the Martyrs USA says the bigger picture remains serious. Christians, Druze, and Alawite minorities have endured multiple attacks in recent months. Pray that international leaders will keep Syria's government accountable to uphold religious freedom. Then, summer fair season is coming to a close in the United States. The iconic Ferris wheel will always hold memories for parents in one Midwest small town, but not in the way that you might expect. Brandon Bauer with The Lighthouse says a high schooler was huffing while driving when he crashed his car into a Ferris wheel and died. Inhalant abuse is popular among teenagers because it's affordable and accessible. The Lighthouse offers a biblical approach to addiction recovery. We'll connect you in the full story at our website. You've been listening to Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. along with my brother Rick. We're examining current events in the light of God's prophetic word. Itamar Marcus, a good friend of Prophecy Today. We did a program with him for Israel Under Fire with John Ankerberg and my father, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung. And Itamar, with Palestinian Media Watch, you're telling us what the Palestinians are saying. You're keeping an eye on for it. Welcome back to the program today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Rick.
Well, Itamar, we were chatting before you came on air, and you wanted me to make sure that our listeners know that most of what you do at PALWatch.org involves the Palestinian Authority and what comes out of their official outlets. There's a difference between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. They are both Palestinian entities, but if you could, just explain the difference between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas.
Yes, the Palestinian Authority is the government that officially was supposed to be running both Judea Samaria, what they call West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. They had a civil war. Hamas took over Gaza already in 2006. The Palestinian Authority is the one that the world believes, I should say, deludes themselves into believing that they're moderate. And it's the one that the international community would like to have take over the Gaza Strip after they destroyed Hamas. And one of the things that we point out regularly in PMW is that there really is no fundamental difference. Neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority would like to have Israel exist, and they're both seeking Israel's destruction.
It even goes so far as to claim that Israel is responsible for the Israelis that were killed on October the 7th, and also equates Israeli prisoners that have been arrested for terrorism with the hostages that were kidnapped, most of them out of their homes in the kibbutzes surrounding Gaza and at that music festival. Can you talk a little bit about how they are using propaganda to blame Israel for October 7th?
Yes, what they're saying is that Israel was so evil for 77 years that Palestinians had a right to attack Israel. Hamas had a right to attack Israel on October 7th. Now, this isn't Hamas saying this. This is the Palestinian Authority. There was an interview just a week ago with a person named Mohammed Shtaya. He was the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority on October 7th. And he described that there was a meeting of the Palestinian leadership on October 7th when they realized what had happened and they saw the dead bodies and they saw the people being kidnapped into Gaza. Everybody knew what was going on. He said, "We made a decision. We made a decision to say that this was an act of self-defense." So that the Palestinian Authority was defending Hamas, defending the raping of people, defending the taking of civilian hostages as an act of self-defense. And they said, "What? Because of Israel's existence, according to the Palestinian Authority, Israel has no right to exist. And until they destroy Israel, any Israelis who they killed is an act of self-defense." This is the Palestinian Authority. Now, the outrageous thing is there's going to be a UN meeting in September, the end of September, second half of September. And at this UN meeting, democratic countries are going to be announcing that they recognize the Palestinian Authority as a state, which is unbelievable. They were recognizing a terror entity, an organization that supported October 7th. They're going to recognize them as a state. We're talking about, like I said, Jabril Rajoub saying this. We're talking about many, many Palestinian leaders. We're talking about the government's decision to say that everything that we have done is self-defense. And these are the people who the Western countries are going to recognize as statehood. It's like giving Iran statehood today. Everybody knows what Iran is today. If we had a choice to take away their statehood and lower their status and create a different country altogether, of course, the whole world would want to do it. But why would you want to create another Iran? It's not going to be as strong, but it has the identical ideology. One might be Shia, one might be Sunni, but they have identical ideology in terms of using terror to impose their own national goals.
I'm speaking with Itamar Marcus from Palestinian Media Watch. You can find out more about him by going to his website at palwatch.org. Itamar, as we look at this situation, not only are they attacking Christians, not only are they attacking the Jewish people, but they are looking at the Jewish religion. They are saying that it is in the Torah. You are commanded by the Torah to kill. They are essentially taking all kinds of things and attacking the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. It doesn't make sense, but they continue to do that. I know you were on Israeli Channel 14 recently talking about this anti-Semitic ideology. Can you tell us a little bit about how it permeates the whole Palestinian situation?
Yes, it's very important because the Palestinian Authority is trying to create a total hatred of Jews and Israelis. And the way they do that is they say, first of all, two things. One, they say it's inherent to the Jewish personality. The evil of the Jew is inherent. They'll say things like Jews are Satan. And when I say they, I'm talking about senior Palestinian Authority officials, Mahmoud al-Abbas, who's Abbas's advisor, the advisor to the head of the Palestinian Authority, to the chairman. He has said that Satan can be in human form, and he was talking about Jews. Satan can be in human form, so the Jews are Satan. So the Jewish people are inherently a problem because we are Satan or Satan's partner in doing evil in the world. And then what they attack is the Torah itself and the Bible, and they say that the Jewish traditions from the Torah demand the murder of non-Jews, etc. It just sort of so happens that, you know, at a time when foreigners around the world and in different countries were treated as total outcasts. When I say total outcasts, I mean the worst thing to be would to be an immigrant, a foreigner. I mean, look at the status in Rome and Greece years later. Look at the Colosseum where they put non-Romans in to fight each other to the death. Judaism in the Torah, and this is of course part of Christian tradition also, the Torah in 36 different places commands that we welcome the immigrant, what they call the stranger, the immigrant, the non-Jew who's living amongst us. 36 other nations didn't care about them. And here it actually, one of the commandments is you should love them like you love yourself. So this is, Judaism is not telling you by any means to go out and murder and kill, but the Palestinian Authority tells its people that this is what Judaism is about. So what they say is the Jewish person is inherently evil, connected to Satan. His personality is just to do evil. And the Jewish religion likewise is doing evil, meaning there is no way of fixing the Jews. That's their message. Therefore, it's justified on behalf of not only Palestinians, but on behalf of all of humanity, it's justified in killing Jews. I just want to add one more note on this. When I say that the conclusion is that it's justified killing Jews, seven times in the last year, their religious leaders on Palestinian TV have said the following quote: count the Jews or count the Zionists one by one, kill them one by one, don't leave even one. Literally call for the extermination of Jews. Not once, seven times. Some of these people are people who have very senior positions in the Palestinian Authority religious establishment. They're presenting the extermination of Jews as a religious goal for Palestinians and for Muslims in general. So what we're having here is the Palestinian Authority is telling their people that they have the obligation to kill Jews. So what do they do? And then they tell their people, why should you be killing them? Because they have in their Torah that they're going to kill you, which of course is the lie. So they create the lie, which is the justification for murder. And then they say, let's go out and let's exterminate the Jews.
Itamar Marcus from Palestinian Media Watch. My final question for you, Itamar. As I said earlier, Israel is certainly winning the war on the ground. They're doing everything they can to achieve their objectives of eliminating Hamas and getting the hostages back. They're doing what they can, but they are losing the war, the quote-unquote, the propaganda war. And then this is a question that I have for you. In your opinion, despite all the evidence to the contrary, why is the world so willing to accept this Palestinian propaganda? What do you think, especially in Europe, but even here in the United States as well? We have our own influencers and politicians that are going against Israel. Thankfully, we have a few that stand for Israel's right to exist and essentially stand for truth, because that's what we're talking about here. But why do you think the world is so willing to accept this propaganda against the Jewish people?
It's hard to understand why people are motivated to hate Jews. It's been a question that Jews have been struggling with for centuries, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And it could be that this is just another manifestation. There were periods, last century, in Europe, it was the racial issue. The Jewish race is terrible. The Jewish race is infecting the wonderful European race. Therefore, we have to purify a race by exterminating the Jews. And so it initiated with the Nazis, but the Poles were involved, and the French were involved. I don't have to go through all the countries that were, some of them passively involved, some very, some of them actively involved. Many Jews actually were killed in their countries when they went back there after the war, not necessarily not by Germany. So, and then there was sort of like this respite we had for, a couple of decades where anti-Semitism, people understood how evil the crematory was and what had happened there, that anti-Semitism had a bad name. And people said, okay, we can't. But all of a sudden, the Palestinian issue and the ability to present Israel as murderers woke these people up. Or woke these sentiments up. And they say, oh, hey, now we have a good reason to hate them. Look what they're doing. They're doing a Holocaust against Palestinians. They're doing a genocide. What was done to them, they're doing to others. So this was not, it's not a conclusion that they're making, but it's an excuse that is enabling this hatred that I fear, unfortunately, might have been there just under the surface all along. Because like I said, historically, it's been under the surface. And this is just an excuse for it to come out again.
That's certainly one of the contentions that we had on this program, that it was lying dormant. And this is, as you said, an excuse to bring it out again as we look at anti-Semitism around the world. Well, Itamar Marcus from Palestinian Media Watch, as I said, you can go to the website palwatch.org, find out more about what Itamar does to kind of keep the world informed about how the Palestinian media is portraying this situation to their own people. Itamar, thanks for being with us. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Itamar Marcus, great job, Itamar. We sure appreciate you being on the program, and we encourage everyone to go to palwatch.org to see what the Palestinians are saying, because you don't always get that in the media. Rick and I are always encouraging folks to have a worldview and to have a biblical worldview. I think that's something that is so very important as believers. We need to know what's happening in the end times and what's happening in the last days, which we are living right now. We started out the program today talking about the times in which we're living, the historic times in which we're living, how God knows all. But what I would say is that what we're seeing is what I referred to in a conference as the times of the Gentiles. I thought it would be good to get my good friend Paul Scharf back on the program. Paul, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jimmy. Great to be back with you.
Yes, sir. And Paul is a Friends of Israel Church Ministries representative with the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministries. Last week, we finished up our conversation, Paul. We were talking about the times of the Gentiles, and I wanted to have you back to explain that. Now, in Luke chapter 21, verse 24, Jesus speaks of future events, including the destruction of Jerusalem and his return. He says that Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So let's talk about the times of the Gentiles. What are the times of the Gentiles?
Well, Jimmy, the times of the Gentiles are the times during which Gentile nations are dominating the world, and more particularly dominating Israel and Jerusalem. They're having dominion over Jerusalem in fulfillment of God's prophetic plan, as Jesus described it here in his Olivet Discourse. And he is talking about the fact that Jerusalem will be overtaken by these Gentile nations. Which nations are they? Well, they're foretold in the book of Daniel, chapter 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and chapter 7 in the vision that Daniel received, which covers the very same time frame and the very same nations, Gentile nations. And of course, you and I know, Jimmy, those are Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be in dominion over Jerusalem. But we praise the Lord, not forever, but we have that blessed word, until. Until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. We know they'll be fulfilled at the coming kingdom when Christ returns, and that stone cut without hands in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2, in other words, it's not of human origin. It comes directly from heaven, and it smashes all the earthly kingdoms, and it rules forever.
So the definition for times of the Gentiles is any time the Gentile world is in control of the Jewish people and the city of Jerusalem. And right. That began with the Babylonians coming in and taking into captivity and destroying the temple in the city of Jerusalem. First starting at 605, then 586, Nebuchadnezzar comes in. And when we talk about those beasts that you mentioned, well, you talked about that's in Daniel chapter 7, the statue in Daniel chapter 2. That one last, in fact, in which we keep our eyes on, is the 10 toes of iron and clay, that mixture, and that terrible beast in Daniel chapter 7, which is still yet to come, correct?
Jimmy, as Daniel the prophet is explaining Nebuchadnezzar's dream to him about these precious metals that he saw that represent the kingdoms of the Gentile world that would trample upon Israel and Jerusalem, as you said, from 605 and 586 down to the end of the tribulation and the establishment of Christ's kingdom, Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar that he himself and Babylon were the head of gold. They're represented by this head of gold. And Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king, are a king of kings. And he says, you are this head of gold. That's Daniel 2, 37 and 38. But then he shares a thought that Nebuchadnezzar would never have thought before. He says, after you shall arise another kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar says, after me, there'll never be a kingdom after me. That's why he builds an entire statue of gold in Daniel chapter 3. To show that he and his kingdom, he believed, would last forever. But these four kingdoms, which look so incredible, so wonderful, shining in the sun from man's perspective, from our earthly perspective, from Nebuchadnezzar's worldly perspective. In Daniel 7, the Lord God gives Daniel a vision of the heavenly perspective of these same kingdoms. And of course, as you said, this time they're horrible, grotesque beasts, a lion with wings, a bear raised up on one side, a leopard with four wings and four heads, and then finally that indescribably horrible beast that represents Rome. And it reminds us of Peter's words in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, and this is a different context, but it it's applicable, I think, to the beasts we see here in Daniel 7. They're like natural brute beasts made to be caught and destroyed. And they're just these horrendous, horrendous, horrific animals, wild animals, that, Jimmy, represent, from God's perspective, the depravity of man, the tyranny that man seeks in rising to power to take control over the world, that'll all culminate in the final world ruler, the Antichrist, who is the coming prince of the same people that destroyed Israel in Jerusalem in AD 70. Mm-hmm. And we know that from Gabriel's explanation to Daniel of the vision of the 70 weeks that Daniel received, and that's in Daniel chapter 9, 26 and 27. It was the people of the prince who was to come who were to destroy Jerusalem in AD 70. The people that destroyed Jerusalem were, of course, the Romans. The Romans will be returning in the revived final phase of the Roman Empire during the coming tribulation.
Mm. So as we look at this, and this really does help us, Paul, in several different ways. I mean, it helps you. Understanding Daniel really helps you, and that's the skeleton as to which we hang all the other prophecies in the Bible, Ezekiel, Revelation, right. Zechariah. You have to get Daniel correct in order to be able to understand Bible prophecy. So this helps us. It's amazing that Daniel could see and, you know, was given this information way before the Roman Empire, before the Grecian Empire, before the Medes and the right. Persians. And so, I mean, again, this validates, and I love how you take it to Rome when they were in charge in AD 70 in the of the city of Jerusalem, bringing down the temple, the destruction, the people. So this really answers a lot of questions for us that we have. So I really appreciate all of that. And of course, the little horn is going to come on that terrible beast. The little horn is one of the 27 right. names for the Antichrist that we've talked about often on this program. And, you know, again, all of these are still yet that the iron, the mixture, the feet of the statue of iron and clay, the 10 toes, and that terrible beast in the future, those are all still yet to come. And we understand that as we read through, having the, you know, the ability to look back over time to understand Bible prophecy. But Daniel just wrote down the things that he understood, and he could look down the road. So we have the ability to look back. Daniel was looking forward and giving us all this information. So let's put it in today's terms. Looking again at Luke chapter 21, we see that Jesus mentions a time in which Jerusalem is under the dominion of Gentile authority. And that is still happening today, correct?
That's right, Jimmy. You know, one amazing truth about all of this, we find in Daniel 7:12, that as the beasts disappear, their dominion is taken away, yet their lives are prolonged. Verse 12 of Daniel 7 says, for a season and a time. That's why when John, the apostle, in the book of Revelation, sees the final Antichrist in Revelation 13, it has the characteristics of all the nations that have come before. It was like a leopard, and feet like a bear, and a mouth like a lion, in Revelation 13:2. So the legacy of each of these nations live on in their successors. When Jesus and his apostles were here on the earth, they were, of course, living in the Roman Empire, walking on Roman roads, but speaking the Greek language. And this influence has continued all the way down through history and will reemerge fiercely in the coming tribulation, of course, as you said, in that final Roman ruler.
Mm. Well, let's take it to the New Testament and one of the themes of Romans chapter 11.
That's an amazing truth, Jimmy, that coincides with all of this, is we know that currently and for the last 2,000 years nearly, the people of Israel have been in their dispersion, and they're partially and temporarily blinded and hardened from the gospel. And Paul teaches this clearly in Romans 11. Again, that wonderful word until that Jesus used with regard to the times of the Gentiles. It's only until those times are fulfilled. And he uses the same word, Paul uses the same word that Jesus used when he talks about the fact that it's only until something happens that the people of Israel are temporarily and partially blinded from the gospel. It's only until Romans 11:25, the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So there's something similar, not the same, but coinciding in part with the times of the Gentiles is the fullness of the Gentiles. We might say the time of the fullness of the Gentiles, that's the time in which God has been working in the church age, primarily among Gentile people, and I know that includes me, Jimmy, and I'm thankful to be included.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, we here in America have been blessed as America for the last four centuries has been really the center of the Christian world in terms of world missions and Christian ministry. That's not because, of course, we're going to bring in the kingdom or because certainly not because we've replaced Israel. But God has blessed us even as a Gentile nation, as Gentile people, and he has given us these incredible blessings during this time. But Jimmy, Paul says to us Gentiles, don't be haughty, don't be proud, don't be arrogant, don't be boastful, because beware of this, there will be a day when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and God will turn his focus from the Gentile world again back to the people of Israel. And the blessed thing for us, of course, is that time will end with the blessed hope, the rapture of the church. We'll be in heaven with Christ, and then God will resume working primarily again through the people of Israel, and there will still be Gentile people saved in the tribulation. That's, of course, another whole story. But God will pour out his grace upon the people of Israel, who I believe are coming back today to their land in preparation for future events to unfold when God restores the people of Israel and returns his focus to the nation of Israel once again.
Yes. When the time is right, God will restore the entire nation of Israel and will come to faith in him once again, ending the times of the Gentiles. And, you know, when you look at it, we've been talking about dispensationalism, the dispensations, the time periods, and we really haven't even looked at the different time periods of world history from the beginning, Genesis chapter 1. But the day of the Lord is a time period when the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, will be restored again, and the times of the Gentiles will come to an end during that seven-year period of time. Well, thank you so much, Paul. Thank you again. And we're going to have you back because I do think it's important. We really need to look at Daniel chapter 9. I know you talked about it today, but in the future, I want to talk about why the tribulation period is for the Jewish people, and we're giving that understanding in the 70th week of Daniel in Daniel chapter 9, and we'll have you back to talk about that in the future, how God will again bring and restore the entire nation of Israel to himself. Thank you, Paul, for joining with us today. I really appreciate your understanding of Scripture, and you could go to, again, where can folks find your information and listen to your sermons and your vignettes and the things that you do?
Thank you, Jimmy. They can always go to sermonaudio.com/PSCHARF, that's PSCHARF. They'll find all my material. They can contact me there, and it's all about all the work that I'm involved in with the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, which I'm so privileged to be involved with and to serve the Lord through this wonderful means. And I thank you, Jimmy, for this great opportunity today.
Thank you, Paul. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, the Legacy Series with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung, as we're exploring God's plan for the ages, right here on Prophecy Today Weekend. Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with my brother Rick, we examine current events in the light of God's prophetic word. Today on the program, we're talking about the time of Jacob's trouble. It's a phrase that comes from Jeremiah 30. Verse 7, which says, "Alas, for the day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." That is future. It is our view that the time of Jacob's trouble corresponds to that seven-year tribulation period of the end times, first mentioned in Daniel chapter 9, again mentioned in Matthew chapter 24, Luke chapter 21, Revelation chapter 6 to Revelation chapter 19, all the time of Jacob's trouble. And it's all there because God is getting the Jewish people to a place where they will recognize that he is God, that his son Jesus Christ was sent to this earth to die for mankind. How do I know all of that? Well, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung, my father, wrote some commentaries. He taught me everything I know, but he also wrote some commentaries that you can have access to. It's Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation. Just go to our website, prophecytoday.com. Well, we're starting a study today, and I thought it would be good to see the plan that was developed by Satan to kill all the Jews on the earth with a terrible Holocaust. And I'm not talking about the Holocaust of World War II, but a worse Holocaust yet to come. The Apostle John in the book of Revelation reveals Satan's plan to kill every Jew. You see, if that happens, then God will not be able to fulfill his promise to the Jewish people. Satan will be the winner. However, that will not happen. Satan will lose in the end. And this is our study for this week. Please take your Bible and go to the book of Revelation, chapter 12. Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series.
Go to the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation, the rapture of the church. Jesus shouts, Archangel shouts, the trumpet of God sounds, and we're out of here to be with him. The rapture, the next activity to take place. And then after that's going to be a seven-year period of time. 7 years of terrible Holocaust. Hello? Holocaust on the face of the earth. Half of the earth's population, 3.5 billion people, are going to be killed. Plus many, many more will come to death. The Bible talks about in the book of Zechariah, chapter 13 and verse 8, 2 out of every 3 Jews will be killed. Listen, the worst Holocaust yet to take place on the earth happened 65 years ago in World War II, when Adolf Hitler killed 6 million people, 6 Jewish million people, because he was trying to set up a kingdom, false doctrine leading to that. By the way, that was 1/3 of the earth's Jewish population at that time. In World War II, there were 18 million Jews. He killed 6 million of them. That left 12 million. We have today approximately 12.5 million Jews upon the earth. The next Holocaust will kill 2 out of every 3. That's 8 million plus Jews yet to be killed. And it's all a result. And what happens from that flood activity? The retribution from the flood. Evil angels playing a key role to kill Jewish people. Go over here to Revelation chapter 12 with me first. Chapter 12, and let me set the stage for chapter 9. Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is at the midway point of the tribulation. The first 3.5 years have been completed. The church, a false church in Rome, was established. Chapter 17, there were 2 witnesses that would preach for 3.5 years, 1,260 days. The text says, that's chapter 11 of the book of Revelation. And then we come to chapter 12 of the book of Revelation, starting in verse 7. Chapter 12 and verse 7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. They prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And that great dragon, by the way, apocalyptic literature, who's the dragon? We're going to get the definition right now in verse 9. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, that old serpent that appeared to Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3. He deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out onto the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Look at verse 12. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea. For the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth he hath but a short time. Look at verse 13. What's the purpose of these evil angels when they come to earth? And when the dragon saw that he was cast onto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. That's apocalyptic literature defined earlier in chapter 12 as the Jewish people, the one who would bring that Messiah. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Skip to verse 17. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keepeth the commandments of God, and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so when Satan and his evil angels are thrown out of heaven, down to the earth, They're going to attack the Jewish people. They're going to try to wipe out the Jewish people. That's only the first stage. Go to chapter 9. By the way, the book of Revelation, listen to me, folks. The book of Revelation, you do not study it numerically. You must study it chronologically if you're going to understand it. Not numerically, chapter 1 to 22, chronologically. I just talked from chapter 12. That's the midway point of the tribulation. And then in the last 3.5 years, the 7 trumpet judgments and the 7 vial judgments unfold. We're now coming to the 5th of the trumpet judgments, chapter 9 and verse 1. And the 5th angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven. That's not a star like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. That's a star like Michael Jordan is a basketball star. And I saw a star fall from heaven. Here's how I know what it's talking about. Unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit, to Satan. The star was given the key to the bottomless pit. Verse 2, and he opened the bottomless pit. And there arose the smoke out of the pit as the smoke of the great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit. This pit, the abyss, the Tartarus, the bottomless pit in the heavenly someplace. I believe a black hole. We can argue about that all day if you want to. But it has evidence that it was in the heavens. How do I know? Because when the door was open, the smoke in it covered the sun. And it said it covered the air. That word air used here in chapter 9 is the same word used in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 when it says, and we shall be caught up to meet him in the air. Someplace in the air, this Tartarus, where these evil angels have been held in prison and they're released. You know what they are? Unidentified flying objects, UFOs, alien creatures. Yeah, I believe in UFOs. I believe in alien creatures. He called them locusts. It's not like any locusts I've ever seen. Grasshoppers, you know? Look here, verse 7. Let's see what these locusts, grasshoppers, look like. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. And on their heads was, as it were, crowns of gold. And their faces were the faces of men. And they had hair as the hair of a woman. And their teeth was the teeth of lions. And they had a breastplate, as it were, breastplates of iron. Look at verse 10. And they had tails like unto scorpions. You ever seen a grasshopper like that? Looks like a horse going to battle, a face of a man, hair of a woman, teeth of a lion, breastplate of a soldier going to war, and a scorpion's tail? I've never seen a grasshopper like that. That's an unidentified flying object. That's an alien creature coming in from outer space in the abyss where they are coming to attack and kill 1/3 of the Earth's population. I'll get to it in just a moment. Yeah, I do believe in unidentified flying objects and aliens. What they are evil angels taking on the form of whatever they want to. Maybe even looking like a saucer, flying saucer. It's evil angels. They're evil angels. No other planet, no other place in all of creation except the earth, which was to be inhabited. Isaiah 48. And so it is. These evil angels attack the earth. Look here. Go to the 6th trumpet judgment. Show you how many it's going to be. The number, verse 16 of chapter 9. The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000. That's 200 million. Evil angels. Somebody say, hey, wait a minute, man. This 200 million, that has to be the militia in Red China. No, it doesn't. Because that's the 6th vial judgment, chapter 16. This is the 6th trumpet judgment. You got a lot of judgments to go. And besides, what did these locusts look like? Horsemen running to battle. 200 million of them are released. And they kill 1/3. Notice here. Verse 18, by these three was the third part of the men killed. That's 1.5 billion. The 4th seal judgment, 1/4 of the earth is killed. At 6 billion people, that would be 1.5 billion, leaving 3/4. You take another third away, that leaves half. That's 1.5 billion killed in the 4th seal judgment. In the 6th trumpet judgment, another 1.5 billion. Half the earth is destroyed, and most of them Jews. Why? Satan realizes, I will be equal with God. I will be worshipped in Jerusalem. We talked about the war in the heavens. That takes place. The aggressiveness of this angelic activity takes place. But listen to me. Evil angels are at work right now. Daniel chapter 11, verses 13 and 20. In verse 13, it talks about the evil angel of Persia. You know who that was? Haman in the book of Esther. The evil angel. This is talking about evil angels taking control of human bodies dispatched by Satan. What did Haman want to do? Kill all the Jews. He had the king Ahasuerus write the law of the Medes and the Persians. Give me the right. I'll kill every Jew. Oh, then in verse 20, it talks about the evil angel taking control of Greece. Well, who was that? Antiochus Epiphanes of Daniel chapter 11. Antiochus Epiphanes comes along, desecrates the temple, the first abomination of desolation, and then wants to kill off the Jews. Evil angels taking control. How do I know that happens? Well, I read Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 12, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities, powers of darkness, evil in the heavenlies, world rulers. Who's the king of this world now? Satan, dispatching evil angels to take control of human world leaders. I stood in front of Yasser Arafat. I am not a psychic. I'm not a mind reader. But I looked at Yasser Arafat right in his eyes. I knew he was evil, completely controlled, demonically controlled, and killing. That's an evil man, satanically controlled. Adolf Hitler, satanically controlled. Do some study about Adolf Hitler. Man, he was into the occult, to witchcraft. He never made a decision without having a seance with a witch. He was demonically controlled and gave the order to kill 6 million Jews. It's happening, but it's not only happening in political activities. It's happening in the pulpit. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. What? Know you not that the devil is an angel of light? Read the rest of it. And his ministers of righteousness. Better check them out. Check me out. Make sure I'm conforming to that book. I don't care who it is. Hold the same standard high, because the pulpit will be controlled by evil angels in the last days to do what? Wipe out the Jews. A holocaust to cause plans of God not to be fulfilled. So Satan takes control. That was the reason for the flood. That's what happened before. What did Jesus say? As it was in the days of Noah, so it shall be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. We're here. Stage is set. All the actors in place. Curtain's about to go up on his second coming.
Indeed, the stage is set for the final drama to be played out. Everything that must be set in place for this final act to begin is in place. I pray that this study has alerted you to the plans of Satan. This study is a reminder of the events of the last days after the rapture of the church. Please use this information to warn others of what is coming. Next week on the broadcast, we begin a brand new study on the city of Babylon. The literal city of Babylon, a city that will play a key role in the last day.
Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series. You know, Dr. DeYoung wanted people to study and understand Bible prophecy and God's Word. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the book right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. Last week, Lebanon's government took another step toward law and order. Its cabinet approved the objectives of a U.S. proposal that would see Hezbollah disarmed by the end of the year. The Iran-backed militant group declared it will ignore this decision, but war with Israel has largely gutted its leadership and diminished its influence. Nuna with Triumph for Mercy Lebanon.
For 40-plus years, nobody could challenge Hezbollah, nobody could say anything.
But the new government this year has taken a stand.
Does this mean that everything's good? No. It means that we are expecting now backlash.
Nuna expects Hezbollah will eventually have to lay down arms, but it might take a new round of military action to make that happen. For now, Lebanon's years of struggle have left its Shiite population desperate for true hope. Pray that Triumph at Mercy Lebanon will see much fruit in gospel ministry to them. And more of Mission Aviation Fellowship's missionary pilots and mechanics today are coming from the very communities they serve. David Holston, MAF president and CEO, says,
we used to see larger numbers of Western missionaries who were serving in remote parts of the world. Unfortunately, the number of missionaries that are going to some of those pioneering parts of the world has decreased. Now, there are national missionaries who are responding to a call that God has placed on their life to reach their own people.
MAF's future vision?
So it could be that an Indonesian pilot joins us to serve in Ecuador, or a mechanic from Mexico joins us and they're able to serve in a place like Nigeria.
Find your place in the story at missionnews.org. Thanks for listening to Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. We're listener supported by people just like you. So by giving to Mission Network News, you enable us to keep the stories of God's kingdom coming. And together, the Great Commission happens. Look for links at missionnews.org. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with Rick, we've been examining current events in the light of God's prophetic words. And I have to show my appreciation, I really do, for our broadcast partners. Ken Timmerman, David Dolan, Itamar Marcus, today, over the past, even Dr. Richard Schmidt, R.C. Merle, Dr. Don DeYoung, all of our broadcast partners bring something to the table that it helps the body of Christ, to understand why the world is acting as it is, what is happening. God is going to keep his promise. He's sovereign. There's so much that we learn from Bible prophecy. And I hope that you appreciate the expertise of each one of these men as they discuss the events, what's happening in the world, what's taking place. And I know that I left some out. I forgot about even Israel Madad and how much impact Menno Kalosher. Yes, I can keep going with all these men and how they help us. We're very appreciative. Rick and I are very appreciative of each one of those. Well, let me just, we started out the program today talking about the time of Jacob's trouble. In Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 10 and 11, the Lord references the blessings that will come after the time of Jacob's trouble. I will surely save you out of a distant place, your descendants from the land of their exile. Jacob will have peace and security, and no one will make him afraid. I am with you and will save you, declares the Lord. The Jewish people are returning to the land of Israel. Remember, that's one of the things that we keep our eyes on as a ministry, the Aliyah, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. As part of the deliverance from the time of Jacob's trouble, the Lord says he will destroy the nations who held Judah and Israel in captivity. And he will never again allow Jacob to be completely destroyed. The Lord also describes this as a time of discipline for his people. He says of Jacob, and that is Israel, though I completely destroy all the nations among which I scattered you, I will not completely destroy you. I will discipline you, but only with justice. I will not let you go entirely unpunished. And that is why that's the time of Jacob's trouble, the day of the Lord, the tribulation period. The reason for that period is so that the Jewish people will understand, and he's disciplining them. And God gives us the answer in Daniel chapter 9. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7 says that day is great, so that none is like it. The only time period that fits the description of this period is the tribulation, and this time is unparalleled in history. Like Jeremiah, Jesus described the tribulation as a unique time of suffering, speaking of great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again, Matthew 24:21. The Lord also uses some of the same imagery as in Jeremiah. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 6 to 8, he said the appearance of false Christ, wars and rumors of wars, famines and earthquakes are the beginning of birth pains. Paul, too, described the tribulation using the same simile of birth pains. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 3 says, while people are saying peace and safety, destruction will come on them suddenly as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. This event follows the rapture and the removal of the church in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. These birth pains are described in detail in Revelation chapters 6 through 12. We focused on chapter 12 today with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series. One purpose of the tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble, is to bring Israel back to the Lord. That's Jeremiah 30, verse 22. That's Hosea chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. That's Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. And we've talked about these passages before. The time of Jacob's trouble demonstrates that God keeps his promises. He judges sin and he saves those who trust in Christ. In the end times, God will pour his judgment on a wicked world. And we know that in this 7-year tribulation, from Israel's point of view, is the time of Jacob's trouble. When you look at that, as we listen today, half of the world's population that's left after the rapture of the church will be gone. God purges his chosen people of the wicked and unbelieving. But everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. For on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, there will be deliverance, as the Lord has said, even among the survivors whom the Lord calls. Joel chapter 2, Romans chapter 10. After that time of Jacob's trouble is a time of peace, as the Lord himself sets up his kingdom on the earth for 1,000 years. Revelation chapter 20, Isaiah chapter 11. So all of these passages today, we're taking a look at the book. I'm giving you the information so that you can study Bible prophecy, so that you will understand where we are in God's timetable, why we are here, what brought us here to this point. Well, at this point, God has sent his son to die for mankind, and that is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And without that, people that die and go to hell, they die and they haven't accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior, they will spend eternity in hell. If you accept Christ, you're in heaven, and we go at the rapture. What happens after that is a purging. It's a time of where God brings judgment on this earth for those people that rejected him, and to help the Jewish people to understand why this world is acting as it is, and that it is God's world. And the same God that I worship, they will be worshiping. The same Messiah that I worship, they will be worshiping. And that's a time of peace and safety in the future. Those Jewish people that come back that are living after the tribulation period. And again, that's not guaranteed, as we heard from Dr. Jimmy DeYoung today. Well, I hope that all of this helps you. And Rick, thank you so much for doing all the hard work today and our interviews, helping us to understand where we are. Helping people to hear the events. And remember, all of these events are setting up for events that happen, prophecies that are fulfilled after the rapture of the church. If we're so close to these events that are listed in the book of Revelation, if we're so close to that, how much closer are we to the rapture of the church? Let's keep looking up until...
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Jay Johnson inviting you to join us again next week for more of Prophecy Today.